and who you don't back, and creating alliances, which is all quite Machiavellian. But I think you can do it with kindness. There's a great phrase that Peter Capaldi used when giving an award, I think, to Armando, and it was, it's nice to be important, but it's important to be nice.
But I think one thing people often don't realise is cross-party friendships do exist within politics.
There's... I find that really interesting.
How so?
I'd always thought that your political tribe was where your alliances were, but actually you're completely correct. I think backstage there's probably more friendships with the opposition than there are within your own party, because within your own party you've got competition and you've got resentment and you've got ambition, whereas with your opposition there's no actual, there isn't that to the same degree. It's a bit like Diane Abbott and Michael Portillo, a fascinating combination when they did their, what was it called?
This Week.
This Week, which I loved. I used to watch that avidly, along with Question Time. And those are my TV go-tos, actually, rather than Bridgerton or something like that.
That was the actor Alex McQueen, who played Julius Nicholson in The Thick of It. That's it for me, Sebastian Payne. Thank you very much for joining. Next on Times Radio, it's Jane Garvey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. 2 o'clock, this is Jane Garvey on Times Radio until four. And on the programme today, bad jobs numbers and a key migration crisis deadline, putting the government under real pressure today. We'll have more on that. 8 years on from the Unite the Right white supremacist rally in the US, we'll discuss who Donald Trump's diehard supporters really are. We'll also have the latest from his deputy's summer holiday here in Blighty. My big interview today, it is a biggie, it's the actress Celia Imrie. She's a novelist. She's soon to be in both Celebrity Traitors and the Netflix adaptation of The Thursday Murder Club. And we'll have news too of a British triumph in sport, albeit one you might not have heard of. More of that in a moment. We'll start with the news at two from Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A would-be hit woman who wore a hijab as she attempted to kill a shopkeeper in Birmingham has been convicted 6 years after the murder plot. Amy Betrow from Wisconsin was recruited to kill Aslat Mohammed by a rival family. Times Radio's deputy head of news, Alex Dibble, has more.
Betrow flew to Britain and was given a clear brief to kill Mohammed and his family. In September 2019, armed with a self-loading pistol, she saw Mohammed's son, Sikandar Ali. She pulled the trigger at close range, but the gun malfunctioned and Ali managed to escape. She then returned that night and fired 3 shots at the family home before flying back to the US. Jurors deliberated for almost 21 hours before delivering their verdict, and Betrow will be sentenced next Thursday.
The Home Office is expected to confirm today that 50,000 people have crossed the channel since Labour took power last year. It would mean the milestone will have been reached quicker than under previous Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Oliver Wright is policy editor at The Times and says these numbers are likely to grab people's attention.
The other number, although it's not directly comparable with today, is that in the first half of this year, the number of people arriving in the UK via small boats was 48% higher than it has been in the same period last year. Now, clearly there is an issue about things like the weather. Most people would say that the weather in this part of the year has been better than the previous year, so that can slightly skew the figures. But nevertheless, for the government, which came in pledging to smash the gangs, these are not good statistics.
Volodymyr Zelensky thanked European leaders for what he calls their clear support for Ukraine's independence, having warned against borders being redrawn. All bar Hungary have appealed to Donald Trump not to exclude Kyiv from talks he's having with Vladimir Putin on Friday, called a feel-out meeting. The US president insists he agrees Ukraine should be involved in any peace agreement discussed with the Russian leader.
I'm going to meet with him. We're going to see what the parameters are. I'm then going to call up President Zelensky and the European leaders, right after the meeting, And I'm going to tell them what kind of a deal. I'm not going to make a deal. It's not up to me to make a deal.
Parts of the UK could get hotter than Bali as an amber heat health alert is in force. Temperatures could hit 34 degrees, putting pressure on health and care services. Dr. Anya Gottfert from the UK Health Security Agency says some people are at greater risk.
Older adults, younger people under the age of 5, people with existing health conditions, those taking certain medications, and pregnant women.
Meanwhile, the National Drought Group is warning England is now suffering from nationally significant water shortfalls. And the Environment Secretary has lined up a team of consultants to prepare for the potential collapse of Britain's biggest water provider. FTI Consulting has been brought in to act as administrators if Thames Water fails to get money from lenders. Steve Reid has signed off the agreement, which would still need court approval. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Hello, good afternoon. This is Jane Garvey, careering with you through the afternoon here on Times Radio, here until 4 o'clock. Loads to cram in, as ever. Love hearing from you. Even a bit of light abuse is all right. I mean, we're all a bit frazzled. It's 0333 003 2353 if you want to get involved. We are still enjoying US Vice President Vance's trip to the UK. Even if the good people of the Cotswolds are not, we'll catch up with Will Humphreys, who's still following Mr. Vance around in a couple of minutes' time, certainly before 2:30, I think, this afternoon. Great Britain has triumphed in the global tug-of-war challenge. Could tug-of-war at some point become an Olympic sport? This programme is going to suggest that it very much does, not least because we are good at it. The health news later with Dr. Sarah Jarvis, why men should avoid so-called unnecessary treatment for prostate cancer. And we're also going to look at the power of melatonin, particularly melatonin gummies. Would you give them to your children if they do have trouble getting to sleep or staying asleep? And my big guest after 3:30 is the fantastic Celia Imrie. She plays Joyce, or she's about to, in the Thursday Murder Club. She's also going to be part of Celebrity Traitors later in the autumn. Now, I tried to get information out of her about that. She was suitably tight-lipped. They're very, very careful, all the celebrities involved in the show. But I think it's fair to say that it was quite the experience for her. She's also a best-selling novelist, and the paperback edition of her World War II saga, Meet Me at Rainbow Corner, is out this week. And we do actually talk to her about Victoria Wood, because Celia worked notably with Victoria as part of the cast of Acorn Antiques. Celia, of course, was Miss Babs, who owned the antique shop where nobody ever bought a single artefact. And that's effectively why Acorn Antiques is no longer in operation. Very sadly, went bust because no customers ever bought anything. So Celia Imrie with me after 3:30 this afternoon. The most read stories on the Times website today at number three, ice cream toting guards escort JD Vance to the UK's poshest farm shop. The US vice president was escorted by his 20-car motorcade as he took his family for lunch yesterday at Daylesford Organic. And we're going to check in with Will Humphreys, our Vance chaser, in a moment. It's worth saying that at Daylesford Organics, you can get 240 grams of hot chilli honey for just £15. The second most read story is vigilante cyclist bike smashed up by the driver of a Fiat 500. Michael Van Erp, better known as Cycling Mikey on social media for his vigilante activism, had his bike smashed by the car after it sped through a no-entry construction zone. And the most read piece on the Times website, it is interesting this, tube passengers face arrest after tackling man with his trousers down. The British Transport Police believe that a man who dropped his trousers on the District Line in East London last week was assaulted. A group of commuters are now facing arrest for kicking and dragging the man off the tube after he refused to pull his trousers back up. It's worth saying that the man who dropped his trousers was very unwell, actually, which is why he did it. But I'm not sure what to think about that, really. What would you have done? I think I know what I'd have done, which is nothing. I'd have moved to a different carriage, if I'm absolutely honest. But let us know what you think. 0333 003 2353. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You'll need a digital subscription, and you can get one by going to thetimes.com/subscribe. All right, welcome to the programme. 8 minutes past two. Let's get stuck in. And the UK's jobs market is cooling. Vacancies are down and the number of people on payrolls are falling as well. Unemployment has remained at a four-year high, and the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is acknowledging the government has a lot more to do. Now, Rachel Reeves is currently on her first official visit to Northern Ireland. We can talk now to Peter McVerry, who's station manager at U105 Belfast. Peter, I've spoken to you many times. You're actually with me in London today. Can we just acknowledge that?
It's a straight swap.
It is.
The chance to perform myself.
And you've come here. Okay. Well, it's great to meet you.
Not sure if you got the best end of the deal.
No, I think I have. Other people, of course, they're completely at liberty to disagree. So why is Rachel Reeves in Northern Ireland?
She's on, as you say, first official visit. She's gone to a couple of businesses. She was in a place this morning called Studio Ulster. Northern Ireland, over the last maybe 20 years or so, has really invested in film production. Studio Ulster is going to take that to the next generation. It's in Belfast Harbour. We've been the home of things like Game of Thrones and Line of Duty. This is really going to extend that and extend what they can do from CGI and all of those sorts of special effects. She's also due to visit Thales, the missile makers in Castlereagh outside Belfast, and to highlight the importance that defence forms to the economy of the UK. And she's due to meet as well with our Deputy First Minister, Emma Pengelly, and with the Finance Minister, John O'Dowd, as well.
Okay, so does she have anything positive to say? I mean, she's visiting some interesting places who are obviously about positivity on the whole.
Yeah, well,
certainly the defence industry is hugely important, isn't it?
She's denied that this is a box-ticking exercise. I'm here, Jane, for a training course. I'm not sure which of us is going to get more from the experience in terms of her being across there and me being across here. She has answered some questions this morning and did say that actually there's great opportunity there for Northern Ireland, but the great opportunity is yet to be defined. The undercurrent to all of this is that Northern Ireland just doesn't have enough money. The Northern Ireland Executive don't really have very many revenue-raising powers. A lot of that sits with Westminster. Northern Ireland believes, and has believed for a number of years, that they should get more money from Westminster. Westminster, under the Barmett formula, believe that Northern Ireland gets enough. It was reviewed, and they get a little bit more. There's also been criticism of the Stormont Executive because the few powers that they do have, for example, water charges and rates, the Stormont Executive haven't been prepared to implement those. The accusation levelled against them is that they just don't want to lose votes, and it's parish pump politics when they need to look at something bigger. So I don't expect Rachel Reeves to come with a bag full of cash.
There are problems in Northern Ireland. I mean, the NHS is really up against it, isn't it?
Longest waiting lists, I think, in Europe, unless that's changed since the last time I checked the facts. And it is. It's really, really up against it. I think 2/3 of the money that the Stormont Executive has goes on health and education combined. And health is just crying out for money and crying out for more money. And the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, has been very clear to say that he just doesn't have the money, never mind to improve the services, to maintain a standstill position.
It's interesting that jobs, particularly in lower paid industries, that's where the jobs are actually falling. And I'm thinking particularly, I guess, about young people who might want a first job or a holiday job, actually, during uni holidays, for example, in the hospitality sector. Tourism is really important to Northern Ireland, isn't it? Increasingly important. It must be tough if you're running a pub or a bar or a cafe. Your employer's national insurance has gone up. Maybe it's going to be much, well, it is clearly, judging by the numbers, harder for you to employ people, but it's harder for these young people to get a foot on the ladder.
Yeah, the trade representatives organisation, like Hospitality Ulster, have spoken about how difficult it is, about how many pubs, for example, are closing. On the reverse of that, and this is the advert, Jane, there's nowhere nicer than Northern Ireland. Any of your listeners, I'd encourage them to come to Northern Ireland. But what is there is fantastic, and that was exemplified recently by the Open, for example, at Royal Port Rush, and
huge
the amount of coverage
though.
That got, and the huge crowds, I think 250,000 plus across the various days, and that showed Northern Ireland off at its best. The issue is just that we need to bring more people to the island of Ireland, and with the Northern Ireland hat on, people like Tourism Northern Ireland will tell you that too many people land in Dublin and turn left to explore the Republic of Ireland rather than turning right out of the airport and coming to Northern Ireland. So self-generated revenue, if you like that, would be fantastic in order to bring about some of those jobs that you're talking about.
And is there a cross-party ability in Northern Ireland to work together with Westminster and what Westminster can or might be able to offer them?
I think there are very few instances when you won't find a difference between the two main power brokers in Northern Ireland, the DUP and Sinn Féin, but I think this might be one issue where they probably are able to sing off the same hymn sheet, even if they don't all want to, because actually going to Westminster and asking for money is something that's going to benefit both of those and probably keep them in power for longer and get them better feedback. So yeah, I think there is probably a united voice in Northern Ireland on the headlines of this. When we get into the weeds and into the detail, there may be some political differences. But for now, definitely, in the ask for money from Rachel Reeves, it's a single ask.
There are still no Sinn Féin MPs at Westminster, are there? I mean, is that ever going to change?
Not taking their seat. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they've been elected, but they don't.
Yeah, so well elected, but as your listeners will know, they don't take the oath and then don't sit in there. So will that change? It's been mooted in the last 18 months. I wouldn't be surprised to see it change, but maybe not go from 0 to 100. Whether or not there will be a way for them to find some fudge, or whether or not, just like other elected members of Parliament who aren't totally comfortable with all of the elements of the House of Commons, maybe there'll be a way for them to take their place and take an oath, but maybe that oath might not be to the monarch.
I can see that might be a way around it. If you're wanting to increase influence, then that might be a better way of establishing more influence if you're actually in the room.
Yes, and the Sinn Féin representatives, the MPs, will tell you that actually they are in London, they are active, that they do engage and influence, and they do take part in all of the meetings. The issue for them is that they're just not sitting in that chamber, and they would argue that the real business isn't done on the benches and it's done in the back rooms.
Interesting. Thank you very much indeed, Peter. Peter McVerry, station manager at U105 Belfast, and Peter's on a training course. I've never been on a training course, Peter. Is it good?
I was going to say I'll come back and join you, but I think I've just missed the key element by coming to talk to you now, so I may need to sign up for a second training course.
I've been on loads of training courses. They just haven't worked, any of them. Peter, thank you very much. Have a good couple of days in London. Let's turn now to the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, already under pressure from reform on the migration crisis. New figures are adding to his pretty almighty domestic headache. More than 50,000 migrants have crossed the Channel since he took office. That is the fastest passing of this milestone for any British Prime Minister. So Theo Usherwood is Times Radio's political correspondent. This is a huge problem for the government in statistical terms, but also because, Theo, people talk about this and they are profoundly worried about it.
Yes, this was a milestone. The Prime Minister, when he came into office after the general election last year, would certainly have hoped that he wouldn't have passed. The now Home Office data shows that 50,271 have made the journey after 474 migrants arrived yesterday. The other figure that's worrying is that as of the end of July, the number of migrants to cross the English Channel was up 48% on the same period last year. And the projections are that we will surpass 50,000 migrant crossings during the course of 2025, which would be a record number, up from a previous high of 46,000. And of course, for the Prime Minister, who is so concerned about the threat of Nigel Farage's Reform Party, this presents probably the greatest headache his time in office right
Sorry
now.
Sorry to interrupt you, Theo, but producer Felix has just told me that figure has in fact now been passed. So it is official and it is over 50,000.
Yes.
So the Smash the Gangs message, which was endlessly trumpeted, it is whatever they're doing, it's not working.
Yes, it was interesting. There was an interview on Times Radio with Seb Payne earlier, Sebastian Payne earlier, where, of course, the danger is that we end up in a situation where, as Lord Kirkhope, the former immigration minister, said, that Keir Starmer falls into the same trap as Rishi Sunak with his slogan of smash the gangs, that you ramp up the rhetoric. Rishi Sunak, of course, had the slogan stop the boats.
Yeah.
Actually, he managed to cut the number of crossings from 46,000 down to 29,000 in his last year in office, but he didn't stop the boats. And that creates a problem in that the government ramps up the anger, it ramps up the rhetoric. We've seen the protests in places like Epping, in Essex. We've seen protests in places like Diss in Norfolk, where these migrant hotels are being used, and in the Britannia Hotel down in Canary Wharf. But actually, the government isn't able to effectively deal with the problem of stopping the number of migrants crossing the English Channel, which then need to be housed in hotels. And all the while, of course, Nigel Farage is waiting there with, we're expecting a policy announcement within the next 2 weeks. He's already called on the Prime Minister to announce that this is a national crisis. And we're expecting him to make a further announcement, Nigel Farage, about exactly what Reform's position is when it comes to housing the migrants, because their whole messaging is around the fairness of, and so it's worth just bearing in mind, not just viewing this in, within the immigration problem. Reform have very effectively managed to use this particular issue to criticise the government when it comes to the winter fuel allowance, when it comes to cuts to disability benefit, that there is money for these hotels. It costs the taxpayer upwards of £6 million a day. All the while, the government, of course, is trying to find savings in other areas of public spending at the same time as putting up taxes. And that becomes a very toxic toxic mix for Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, to deal with. And we're expecting the Chancellor to announce further tax rises in the autumn budget in order to balance the black, you know, to deal with the black hole, which is now expected to land somewhere around £50 billion, having previously promised that she wouldn't put up taxes.
Well, I hope Rachel Reeves is enjoying her time in Northern Ireland. Quite a lot of work awaits a full in tray when she gets back to London. Thank you. That was Theo Usherwood, Times Radio's political correspondent. Coming up next, what is JD Vance doing today on his holiday in the Cotswolds? That's next. It's 20 past two.
Tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
As the Prime Minister says peace shouldn't be imposed on Ukraine. We'll be going through the UK politics with Politico's Anne McElvoy. And the man who can exercise the most influence on President Putin, Donald Trump. We'll be looking at the latest US politics in the Trump dump with the US Assistant Editor David Charter. We'll go through all the biggest stories of the day with the Times' former diplomatic editor Michael Binion and the crossbench peer Claire Fox.
Tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as SAINTS, could help. SAINTS has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. SAINTS is managed by Bailey Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baileygifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
By river, ocean and expedition, you can now explore all seven continents with Viking. Start planning your journey today and discover for yourself why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
And so to the US Vice President J.D. Vance and his family, who are continuing their summer holiday in the Cotswolds. So far, J.D. has mused about the crisis in Ukraine. He's met the Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, and he's been to that incredibly posh, and it has to be said, expensive farm shop. Our man inside the Ring of Steel with his sunglasses and his shorts, I'm assuming, is the Times' Will Humphreys. So what's on the agenda today, Will? Where are you?
Hi there, Jane. I am back in the sort of Chadlington area. There's been no movement from the motorcade today. They seem to be holed up in their manor house, enjoying the pool and the 6 acres of grounds. But there has been some interesting goings on inside the Ring of Steel. The villagers have started putting up protest placards saying, "Vance, go home. Fascists not welcome here. And stop funding genocide." They were put up yesterday by a group of very cheesed off villagers, but they were mysteriously torn down during the night. They don't think it was other villagers tearing it down. They think it was the Americans.
Can we be sure that those posters, placards were put up by locals? We know that, do we?
Yes, I've spoken to the locals who have put them up. I've met them today. They came out of the Ring of Steel to speak to me because I'm not allowed in. But I've seen the photos that they took of them up on the village that I've been in before the lockdown took place. So I'm very sure that happened, and they say they were taken down last night.
So what you're hinting at, perhaps more than hinting, is that members of the Secret Service have had their wicked way with these methods of protest.
Possibly. The locals seem to be very, talk very fondly and highly of the British police, saying they're very sort of personable and they're as sort of annoyed at having to be there as the villagers. And there's only about 15 households in the hamlet.
Right.
And of that, around 11 or 12 are permanent residents. And they don't think that any of the other residents have taken these down. It was three households that put the placards up. There are others who have spoken to me who are also annoyed but didn't sort of go as far as putting up protest placards.
Right.
They're convinced that it's the Americans who've taken them down.
Okay, well, but we don't have any actual evidence that it is. I'm just hedging all my bets here, just in case.
We have no evidence that it is, no.
No, okay. Well, we couldn't have made that any clearer, but we've talked about it anyway. I mean, I love the idea that you say that they're holed up in. I mean, it's a gorgeous manor house, isn't it, with a pool. Temperatures probably in the early 30s. I mean, this is absolutely, what a wonderful way to spend your holiday.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, I don't really know why they would want to get back into a 19-vehicle motorcade and spend all that annoying amount of time sort of waiting for security to say, yes, you can go in here, or no, you can't leave yet, because we haven't got everyone back in their vehicles. I would have to spend my holiday there and not go to Daylesford Farm Shop. And I'm sure they're having a lovely time. And they've got three young children. I'm sure the children will be having a more fun time in the pool than sort of glad-handing with lords and ladies and millionaires over lunches.
I think you're probably right. Thank you very much, Will. That's Will Humphreys. Our man, I'm going to just repeat it because I love saying it, our man inside the Ring of Steel in the Cotswolds, where the Vances continue their summer holiday. And I just love the idea that they'll go back to the States thinking this is what the weather is always like in England in August, because we all know that isn't true. Nevertheless, I think it's time the band struck up and we had some patriotic music. Team GB have triumphed, dragging Switzerland into the dirt to take the gold medal in the tug of war. Yes, it was victory for the men's team at the World Games held in China in the city of Chengdu. The team itself, unfortunately, well, they're flying home, so I can't speak to any representative of the team, but we can actually go higher up the tug-of-war chain to Alan Knott of the Tug-of-War Association. Alan, good afternoon to you.
Hi, good afternoon. You okay?
Yeah, I'm great. You must be chuffed.
Oh, yeah, over the moon. I mean, I've been keeping in touch with the guys whilst I've been over there, and they're just all absolutely buzzing about it. It's the biggest thing they can win in tug-of-war. You know, the World Games is sort of the pinnacle for us. It's the one step below the Olympic Games. It's sort of the stepping stone for a lot of sports to go up to that in the future. So, you know, in the past you've had rugby sevens and the sort of speed climbing have been in the World Games in the past. So, you know, we're hoping that one day we'll be back up there again with them.
It isn't entirely unrealistic, is it? As you say, I mean, there's certainly precedent, and this bodes very well if the tug of war does get into the Olympics. Great Britain sound like they'll be in a pretty good place.
Yeah, we'd like to think so. So, you know, it's always hard to get in the Olympics. There's so many hoops and hurdles you have to jump through to get into big events like that. But, you know, we keep trying and hopefully one day it might happen. But I imagine it's a long way off. But we'll see.
Well, how many different nationalities were competing in China?
Well, the World Games takes place every 4 years. So what happens is that the Tug of War World Championships that happens 12 months previously, the sort of top six countries from that event qualify to go to the World Games. So our team's been preparing for it since last September, at the World Champions that way. So, this is the third World Games in a row now where Great Britain have won the gold. So it's a pretty mega achievement, really.
Now, I'm really impressed that the team are a quite wide mix of ages. There's somebody of 23 and it goes right up to 74. Now, how is it possible for a 74-year-old to compete at this level in tug-of-war?
A lot of it's just keeping yourself fit and healthy over your lifetime, really. You know, it's whether you do sport or not, it's important to look after your health and your body. And, you know, if you stick to it and sort of keep up the training, obviously, as you get older, you will vary the training you do. You won't be doing what a 23-year-old's doing, certainly. But, you know, you do try and keep up. But obviously, because you're not having to do the sort of, you know, running down the wing and chasing after an 18-year-old sprinter or football or anything like that. And it's non-contact sport as well, so you're not getting sort of battered and bruised on a rugby pitch or anything like that. There's a bit more longevity into it that way. Yeah. But yeah.
So what is it you need? I mean, is it core strength, upper arm strength? What?
It's your whole body, really. So I guess the nearest analogy you can sort of think of is a rower. You know, you look at a rower, they're using their arms, the back, the shoulders, the legs to sort of get the momentum that way. And tug war is no different, really, in terms of the sort of all the different muscle groups that you need to use. Obviously, this technique is different to rowing, but the sort of principle is the same.
How long does the match, game, event go on for?
It depends on the sort of teams and the opposition you're up against. Obviously, if you're two evenly matched teams, it can be, you know, 3 or 4 minutes per end, sometimes a little bit longer. If you're a lot stronger than the other team, you know, it can be over in, you know, 20, 30 seconds. It depends. And the ground conditions can make a difference as well. You know, obviously, if the ground's sort of been baked dry in the sun, like it has been this year, you sort of tend not to get lengthy ends. But obviously, if it sort of cuts up a bit more or a bit softer and damper, then, you know, the ends can last a bit longer. So there's a lot of variation in it.
Yeah, that's just fascinating. And I don't want to be ageist, but I am, I suppose, obsessed slightly by the 74-year-old. Where would he stand? At the front, at the back, in the middle? Where?
Well, in this case, he was the reserve on the team, but sort of when he's been competing in the team, he pulls towards the back end, really. But it depends on the balance of everyone that's sort of involved in the team, really, and where you position people. And that's sort of trial and error from when you're training.
Can I just finish with the question I've been asked to ask you by a producer? It says, how many pullers are there in the UK?
Across the UK, we have all the home countries have their own associations, so England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. Sort of speaking from England's point of view, which is my main association, we've probably got about sort of 400 or 500 pullers, and we've got a broad spectrum of age range. So we have junior competitions, under 23 competitions, and into your seniors, where, you know, that we don't have an age limit as such as to when people can get involved. And obviously, we have men's, ladies, and mixed competitions as well. So there's, you know, it's a sport that, you know, everyone can from all walks of life can get involved in.
Brilliant. Well, congratulations. The team consists of Will, Gaz, Jack, Dan, Lee, Dan, Joe, Paul, Ian and Richard, and their coach is a man called Tim Lee. So congratulations to the Great Britain Tug of War team who've done us proud there in the World Games and the Olympics. Surely the Tug of War will be allowed into the Olympics in my lifetime, and I do intend to live a very long time. Right, it's just after 2:30. Next on Times Radio is President Trump's MAGA base still rallying behind his leadership. Laura Cook has got the latest news headlines.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Government figures show 474 migrants cross the English Channel in 8 small boats yesterday, taking the total above 50,000 since Keir Starmer came into power. The number was hit later in the tenures of Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson. A would-be assassin who flew from the US to kill a Birmingham shop owner as part of a feud has been found guilty of conspiracy to murder. A court heard how Amy Betrow attempted to shoot Sikandar Ali outside his home in September 2019, but the gun jammed, allowing him to flee. DCI Alistair Orenka says the 45-year-old extradited from Armenia in January didn't expect to get caught.
I think she fell foul of a really slick, dynamic law enforcement operation over here. I don't know whether that was her perspective from America, that's how we operate, but zero tolerance around firearms criminality.
European leaders have warned against Ukrainian borders being redrawn by force ahead of a meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin in Alaska on Friday. The statement was signed by all EU states except Hungary. The Environment Secretary has lined up a team of consultants to prepare for the potential collapse of Britain's biggest water provider. FTI Consulting has been brought in to act as administrators if Thames Water fails to get money from lenders. Steve Reed has signed off the agreement, which would still need court approval. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
The road stretches before you, but there's trouble ahead. Stationary cars. You're faced with the McDonald's side mission. Do you A, join the ever-growing queue, or B, take the next exit and treat yourself to a glorious Mackey's?
Detouring to McDonald's.
Start your side mission today.
Fly direct to Texas and embark on a truly epic road trip adventure, because there's no place on earth like the Lone Star State. Explore miles of music, food, and culture from hill country to the Panhandle Plains. Experience cowboy grit, heritage, legendary hospitality, and those unbeatable cinematic sunsets in the great outdoors. Drive and discover your Texan road adventure at TexasFrontiers.com. Expand your frontiers.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, it's Jane Garvey on Times Radio until 4. Callum MacDonald will pick up where I leave off at 4 o'clock and guide you through the rest of the afternoon and the rather sweaty evening here in central London. But I'd love to talk to Callum about the programme, hoping he'll turn up at some point between now and 4 o'clock. But I know he's got lots and lots of prep to do. But Callum with you from 4 on Times Radio. Oh, he's coming in now, which gives me an opportunity to mention Mary. Oh, he's not coming in. He's coming in 10 minutes. God, get him. It gives me an opportunity to mention the WhatsApp from Mary, who says, Jane, the bigger tug of war this week was between the Ambridge locals against the Jim Bunnies from Grey Gables in the Archers. Oh, then she reveals who won. I'm weeks behind, Mary. I don't want any spoilers from you about what's going on in Ambridge. Thank you for that. 0333 003 2353. The big guest this afternoon is the fantastic actress Celia Imrie. She's talking about her latest novel, which is out in paperback this week. She talks a little bit about the Thursday Murder Club. She's in that as well. And she gives us a few hints. I mean, she's pretty careful about her appearance in Celebrity Traitors, which is coming out in the autumn. That's Celia Imrie from about 3:30. Tomorrow, the big guest at that time is Nicola Sturgeon. And then on Thursday, it's the novelist Val McDermid. So some interesting guests on the programme this week. Now, Donald Trump has signed an executive order extending the cliff edge deadline for higher tariffs on China by another 90 days. This new pause was brought in just hours before the last extension was due to end. That would have sent tariffs back to triple digit rates. Let's have a quick word with Dan Ives, who's a US financial analyst and the managing director of Wedbush Securities. Dan, first of all, is this just plain and simple good news? Well, it's not.
Yeah, it's good news. Oh, I mean, look, it kicks the can down the road, but it shows that negotiations is going to continue to happen between US and China. And that's a good thing for US tech. And it's a good thing for the AI revolution.
Tell me more about the AI revolution. What's the link exactly?
The link is, I mean, big tech, when you think about the products, semiconductors, yeah, chips, hardware, where is it coming from? China. So it comes down to like the U.S. needs China just like China needs the U.S. And that's why Trump administration is going to be so focused on negotiations, especially relative to where they were in April. It's going to be this game of poker that's played between U.S. and China.
I mean, I wonder how financial people in the financial industries, investors, how do they treat this will he, won't he game around the tariffs? Do they take Trump's threats at all seriously?
I think you take it with a grain of salt. I think a lot of this stuff is in pencil, invisible ink. It's not in pen. And I think the market has learned how to play it. I'm not going to say saying the taco trade, but you need to view it like, okay, he's saying that. What's his second and third move? And I think that's how investors have been able to play the markets under Trump. And look, it's new rules of the game.
I think we're going to have to... Thank you, Dan. I'm going to have to let Dan Ives go. He remains a US financial analyst and the managing director of Wedbush Securities. But the signal there was pretty wavy. I think we can acknowledge that. It's worth saying that today, I can't believe actually how far away we've already travelled from this pretty appalling event. 8 years ago today, since one of the most shocking moments of Donald Trump's first term, these white supremacists marching through the streets of Charlottesville in Virginia, holding torches and chanting.
You will not replace us! You will not replace us!
It's pretty horrific scenes, and at the time, those scenes shocked the entire world, sparking questions about who exactly Donald Trump's supporters included. Well, almost a decade on, and with Donald Trump very firmly back in the White House, we thought we'd look again at who makes up the president's supporters and why. James Johnson is a pollster and the founder of the company JL Partners. Many of us in the UK don't get the appeal of Donald Trump. Plenty of people in the UK do, of course. How popular is he in the States right now, James?
So his approval rating is at around 49% in our latest polling. Now, actually, it slightly varies depending on which poll you use. There's a set of polls that have it near where we are. There's some polls who have him a lot less popular. Our view is that he's around that 49% mark, and we think we're picking up people who aren't too politically interested, so people are not skewing the polls in that way. And look, by presidential standards, that's not great. Mm. You know, Obama had a higher approval rating, George Bush had a higher approval rating. But by Trump standards, that is significantly higher than where he was in his first term. So I don't see out here in the States an abandonment of Trump by his voters. In fact, his approval rating with his base, with those people that voted for him in 2024, is at 91%.
Wow. Okay. You did mention there, and I just wanted to make sure I've understood this correctly, that people who understand or know about politics skew the polling. Are you saying that people who know about politics don't like Donald Trump on the whole?
That, yes. If you're more engaged in American politics, then you are more likely to lean left or be Democrat. Actually, the interesting thing is in the UK, that actually splits about even. You're about as likely to be right or left if you're interested in politics. But engagement in the US means that you're more likely to be younger, you're more likely to be higher educated, you're more likely to be online a lot during the day, getting online news, and all of those things make someone more likely to be Democrat. So my view is that some of these polls, we've had Gallup, we've had Ipsos, we've had other polling firms with Trump's approval down at 37, 38%. My view is that those polls are picking up people who are just too politically interested at this point in the cycle. Because think about it, if you're going out with a poll to the American public, the people you're going to pick up are the people who are more likely to be clamoring to answer a poll. Now, what we do and what other firms do is control for political interest. So we make sure we're only getting enough people in the sample who have that high level of interest. We're making sure we're getting those more blue collar, less interested people and voters into the sample. So that's my view on the difference. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's my sense of what the polling looks like in America.
It's very interesting. I really struggle to understand how you could be ambivalent about Donald Trump. I don't understand the I don't knows or the don't minds. They're the people that completely baffle me.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's not many of them. When you take out the when you put in the don't knows in these polls, you often get only around 5 or 6%. So it's not that the disengaged people don't know what they think about Donald Trump. It's that they actually quite like him and think he's doing an okay job. And what I hear in the focus groups and in the interviews that I do is voters saying, okay, he might be a bit brash, he might be a bit aggressive, I might not agree with everyone, but goodness me, he is doing what he said he'd do. And that's the main factor behind his popularity with those more disengaged voters.
Okay, and many of those disengaged voters would never dream of attending an event like that hideous rally in Charlottesville. But nevertheless, we have to acknowledge that amongst that crowd on that day 8 years ago are many supporters of Donald Trump.
But yes, I'm sure that's the case. It's interesting, you know. Perhaps it's to do with Trump winning that second term, but you don't see as much of that ugly side of the MAGA movement today in U.S. politics. I don't know exactly why that is. Obviously, we had a similar sort of situation with Jan 6 in 2021. So those components absolutely do exist. But I think in terms of mainstream Republican politics, you see a bit less of that now. And of course, I'm a humble nonpartisan pollster, of course, but my Republican friends here in the US would turn around and say there's plenty of worrying elements of the left on, for example, the issue of Israel and the Jewish people.
Right. Okay. I'm glad you've made that point, that those views are certainly out there too. If you follow Donald Trump or the White House on social media, they are frequent posters, it's fair to say. And today I happened to look at some of the comments underneath the posts about getting the National Guard out into Washington, D.C., which obviously they are trumpeting at the White House because that was announced yesterday. But I have to say, all the comments underneath the post were just about the Epstein files. This hasn't gone away, has it?
It is stalking Donald Trump, but I will make one point there, which is that it has not gone away if you are a very online commentator or poster. For most people, for the vast majority of Americans, this is not a big issue. And in fact, CNN did a poll a few weeks ago where they asked people what is the biggest issue facing America. And only one respondent in their poll of around 2,000 people said the Epstein files. Now, I do think that Republicans don't necessarily agree with the president on it. I think Republicans do want to know more. They want more of the files released. They doubt the president's account. But it's not enough to erode that sympathy and support for President Trump. They're worried about it, but they don't care about it enough to dent their loyalty. Do you remember that time, I think it was in 2016, when Donald Trump said he could go out and shoot people on Fifth Avenue in New York and his voters would still back him? I think that same dynamic might be happening on the Epstein files.
Okay, interesting. And foreign affairs, lots of people, obviously across Ukraine, plenty of people in Europe are concerned about what might happen, what might come out of the talks in Alaska between Putin and Trump. Does any of that have an impact on his support and supporters?
Yeah, I mean, look, his supporters will really go where he is on this. You know, after that shakedown of President Zelensky in the Oval Office back at the start of the year, all the Trump supporters were saying Zelensky is the problem, Zelensky's corrupt, and we need to back President Trump and pull funding for Ukraine. Now that Trump has taken a tougher position on Putin, all those same supporters are now saying we need to take a tough position on Putin and we need to back Zelensky. So Trump's voters will go with Trump on this. And whether that means a good outcome for Ukraine or a bad one on Friday, that's where I think his voters will go. It's another one where I think he can get away with a lot. But one thing I will make very clear is that Republican voters, even those who are big supporters of Trump, they do not like Putin one bit. We asked them in one word, how would you sum up Putin? And the most common two words were evil and dictator. So there is a tension there. Trump can't be seen to cozy up too much to Putin, even with his most loyal supporters.
Really interesting. Thank you very much indeed, James. James Johnson, who is a pollster and founder of JL Partners. And there'll be full coverage, of course, on Times Radio of that summit between President Putin and President Trump on Friday. In Alaska, which is in the United States, although I think it was yesterday, wasn't it, Callum, you told me that Donald Trump thought it was in Russia.
Russia, yes. He said he'd be going to Russia to meet Vladimir Putin.
Donald, you're not going to Russia.
No.
He's coming to you, which, by the way, plenty of people have got a view on. Anyway, Callum is now here.
Hello.
And he starts on Times Radio at 4. What have you got?
I'm so sorry I'm late. Oh. I was engrossed in conversation with Big Boss Tim on the phone, and so I lost track of the time. I'm sorry. I apologise.
Right.
Hello.
He never rings me. Anyway, carry on.
Coming up from 4, we will continue looking ahead to the Alaska summit. I'm particularly intrigued by what might be tension between number 10 and Sir Keir Starmer and European leaders. There's some reporting today that number 10 has issued something of a warning to other European leaders to say, do you know what, stop mouthing off in public about Donald, I'm paraphrasing,
yeah.
Stop mouthing off in public about Donald Trump. Actually, he prefers it when things happen behind the scenes
and then perhaps he can go on and have the limelight himself. So this is in particular a reference, I think, to President Macron of France, Chancellor Merz of Germany, and the EU Commission chiefs as well, who have been kind of talking in the last 24 hours or so about their ambitions for this summit and land swaps shouldn't happen and all this sort of stuff. So it's that, I think that dynamic is one we'll try to explore actually today, just to understand what is actually happening in Europe. Also, at the beginning of the week, Jane, I said to the wonderful team out there, a bottle of champagne if you book the governor of Alaska to talk to us about this. We don't have the governor of Alaska, but I think I'll be reaching for a nice Sauvignon Blanc for somebody, for getting a Democratic senator from Alaska on just how this is all going down in the state. This is now the centre of the universe, yeah, all of a sudden, over these next few days. So actually, what does this mean for Alaska, which obviously has historic ties to Russia as well, and in some parts of Russia, as Catherine Philp was explaining on Times Radio yesterday, in some parts of Russia there's still a claim, Russian nationalists think, yes, that they own Alaska and that it's a great injustice that it's not
Hence
Russian.
Donald Trump's confusion.
That's right, yeah. It's an easy mistake to make.
Are you familiar with it's a fantastic song by Michelle Schacht.
I'm not.
Anchored Down in Anchorage, Alaska.
Well, that sounds good.
Ryan will dig it out. It's a great song. And they are meeting in Anchorage, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, that's right, I think. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, I've just a bit of pop knowledge.
No,
there.
That's great. Well, you're far more cultured than I am, as if we needed evidence
older,
of that.
I'm just older, I think. Just remember that song.
Cultured.
It is really good. I'm just waiting to see if Ryan can get hold of it.
He's pretty nimble on the buttons.
Oh, no, he is.
I can tell you about something else in the programme, if that helps.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, great. So what else we've got on Drive? We've got, what John usually does, his look at AI, his weekly look at AI. Unlocking AI is what it's called. So we've got Alexandra Ebert joining us from that. She is Chief Trust Officer. This is the sort of world we're entering now, where you need chief trust officers. We've also got H.R. McMaster, former National Security Advisor, indeed, to President Trump, for another of John's regular features, which is called Battlefield, considering the state of the various battles, it has to be said, that are happening around the world.
OK, that's all later with Callum McDonald here on Times Radio. Ryan can't find it. It's a real shame because it's such a good song. Plenty of people will know it. Anonymous says, can you go half an hour on this station without mentioning Trump? Not at the moment.
It's quite difficult.
It's very difficult. We're talking health news with Dr. Sarah Jarvis in a moment or two. It's Times Radio. It's 10 to 3.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Ta. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you? Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business-ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
Huh. Direct Line's flexible business cover means I only pay for the cover I need. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like dominating the pub quiz.
Final question? What is the population of Mongolia?
3,537,947.
It's absolutely correct. This week's winner is none of your quizness.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.
This is Times Radio.
Our anonymous correspondent, please put your name, because it's just nice to mention your names. We can do your shout-out. Anonymous says, Alaska belonged to Russia until 1867. So actually, it's quite an appropriate setting for talks about bits of land that have belonged to one or other country at some point. Right. Thank you very much for that. The WhatsApp is 0333 003 2353. It's hot, certainly in England. In fact, the whole of England is under a heat health alert because of the hot weather, which is expected to have highs today of around 34 Celsius. In truth, I gather it's only peaked at a mere 32.6 Celsius at London's fashionable Heathrow Airport. But this amber alert will mean there is possible disruption to travel and, of course, increased demand on the health service. So how can you help the NHS cope with the heat by helping yourself to cope with it? Sarah Jarvis is a doctor, GP and clinical consultant at Patient Access. Sarah, some people are really not good in the heat, the very elderly and actually the very young. Who struggles the most?
So you're absolutely right. So the very elderly often don't know, don't learn or don't get the same messages. They don't respond and they can't respond, for instance, to thirst in the same way as younger people. And of course, children and very small babies in particular are really bad at regulating their temperatures because their mechanisms haven't kicked in as well yet. But also they've got a much higher surface area through which they lose fluid. And you don't need to lose very much fluid as a baby in order to get dehydrated. But there are also lots of other people. So people who've got chronic lung disease, chronic heart disease, liver problems, kidney problems, chronic kidney disease in particular is a real issue. Type 2 diabetes or indeed type 1. All of these people are at higher risk of becoming dehydrated and, importantly, heat exhaustion and heat stroke.
So if you are a carer today, whether it's for somebody vulnerable, somebody old, somebody young, do you really have to encourage lots and lots of water?
You absolutely do, particularly with older people who, again, as I say, don't really get the same messages in terms of whether or not they're really thirsty.
So, well, can I just say, as a generation, Sarah, sometimes the elderly can be a bit resistant to drinking water. I mean, they might have tea.
Of course, let's not forget. We mustn't forget that it doesn't just need to be water. Any non-alcoholic fluid will do. There are lots of myths out there about how you can't drink any coffee or any tea because it'll dehydrate you. That's not the case. That is true of alcohol. So steer clear of alcohol, but actually up to about 400 milligrams a day of caffeine, which is like 8 cups of tea or 4 cups of brewed coffee or 4 mugs of normal coffee, then that's absolutely fine. It can contribute towards your fluid intake. So, you know, if your great aunt Ethel doesn't fancy a cold drink, by all means, give her another cup of tea. And of course, if she likes coffee and wants the decaffeinated version, she can have as much as she wants instead of water.
Okay. I'm interested in melatonin, which lots of people seem to be taking to help them sleep. Now, as I understand it, you can't buy it over the counter in this country. Can you explain why not?
Well, I'm not absolutely certain. Interestingly, you can get it incredibly easily when you're over in the States, for instance. So you can buy it in supermarkets. And I know because I bought some from my husband who really struggles to sleep. And he is in the group who would otherwise be able to get it on the NHS, because you can get it on the NHS from your GP in certain circumstances if you're over 55 and you're having problems sleeping. So melatonin is a hormone. It's a natural hormone and it is produced by your pineal gland, which basically regulates what's called your circadian rhythm. In other words, your 24-hour cycle, and it's produced by the pineal gland in response to darkness. That helps to control your body's sleep-wake cycle. Now, in the UK, it is available on the NHS pretty routinely for over 55s who are struggling with sleep. One of the points to make, though, is that actually we always prefer behavioural problems wherever. But I think one of the big issues I've seen recently is particularly young people, parents coming to me in desperation and saying, I'm getting it over the counter, or I'm buying it, you know, under the counter, actually, because I'm desperate for my child's sleep.
And is it OK to give your child a melatonin gummy?
Well, the problem is we absolutely don't know. And that would be to make me feel really, really nervous, because the simple fact of the matter is, you know, this is a hormone. We know that hormones have huge effects on your body. Yes, you might say, oh, well, it's a natural hormone. Yeah, you know what? So's deadly nightshade. That's a natural hormone, or so's botulinum toxin. And it can be lethal in the wrong dose given to the wrong people. So my big concern, I think, for young people is, firstly, why are we needing to resort for it? And it's usually because, unfortunately, mental health services, particularly for young people who've got autistic spectrum disorder or who've got ADHD, are absolutely on their knees. They're virtually non-existent within the NHS. So we don't have people who can provide the behavioural support services. And secondly, we just don't know about the long-term effects. Okay. However, if you've got a child who, you know, literally all of you are completely at your wit's end and you are utterly desperate. And I've heard cases where people have been suicidal as a result of they or their child's problems. You know, I think that you might feel that the balance was swung another way.
Thank you very much for that. A brief word, and I know this is an important issue. Outdated guidelines mean that thousands of men are getting unnecessary treatment for prostate cancer. This is according to the charity Prostate Cancer UK. And as I understand it, I'm trying to sum it up relatively quickly. We are now better able to determine what sort of cases are relatively low risk. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So basically, let's not forget that prostate cancer is incredibly common. It is the single biggest cause of cancer among men, and it's one of the single biggest killers among men. About 50,000 men are diagnosed with cancer, prostate cancer, every year, and about 12,000 die from it. But an awful lot of them have what we call doves rather than hawks in terms of their cancer. In other words, they would die if it's diagnosed with prostate cancer rather than from prostate cancer. We also know that the treatments have lots of side effects, whether it's radiotherapy, whether it's chemotherapy, whether it's medication, hormone therapy, which is effectively chemical castration. All of these things can cause significant side effects. So there's something called active surveillance, and that means you're very closely monitored so that if your parameters do go up and it looks as if you're at increased risk, then the team can jump in quickly and give you treatment at that stage. And the argument that's coming here from Prostate Cancer UK is that we should be putting more men and we should be having more national latest evidence-based guidance on active surveillance.
So you think the charity's right?
I think it is. If we've got 35 hospitals which have created their own guidance, and given that the NICE guideline that we've got is unfortunately many years old, things have moved on. There's been a lot of research into prostate cancer. And my suspicion is that we should be either be using, for instance, European guidance, which is updated much more often, or we should be looking at more consistent guidelines with the latest evidence.
Thank you very much indeed for your time, Sarah. That is Dr. Sarah Jarvis giving us the health news of the week. Sarah is a GP and a clinical consultant at Patient Access. I just want to thank Matt in Nottingham, who does say Michelle Shock's early stuff was great, but then she got into a very intense American style of evangelical Christianity, and now you can't get her stuff anymore. But to be fair, Ian in Raynes Park agrees with me, and Anchored Down in Anchorage is a great song, he says. Thank you. It's almost 3 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio until four. In the next hour, is our teetering NHS behind the huge spike in attacks on emergency workers? We'll talk to a representative of the Royal College of Nursing. Are fears of a Russian breakthrough in Ukraine's east overblown? And are problems building up for the Ukrainian army there, though? We will get the latest from a war correspondent. Our big interview after 3.30 is with the actress and very successful author, Celia Imrie. She's got a paperback edition of her latest novel coming out on Thursday, and she's about to star in the Thursday Murder Club and in Celebrity Traitors. You can hear from Celia after 3.30. First, let's get the latest news. Here's Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Conservative peer and former Immigration Minister Lord Kirkhope has told Times Radio the use of rhetoric such as smash the gangs is a very, very dangerous thing to deploy. Figures published by the Home Office today show 474 people crossed the Channel yesterday in 8 small boats, meaning a total of 50,000 migrants have crossed since Keir Starmer became Prime Minister. The Conservatives say Labour's plan is nothing more than a slogan. Lord Kirkhope said the choice of words is very important.
I have criticised my own party in the past when in government. I believe, actually, that usually if you show that you're doing something and you're effective in that and you do it calmly but with determination, then people tend to come round and we avoid this, what we have seen, which is not only rhetoric from my own party, but I'm sad to say now a growing level of rhetoric from the government and, needless to say, from all the more extreme parties in this country.
would-be assassin's been found guilty of conspiracy to murder, having flown from the US to shoot a shopkeeper outside his home in Birmingham. Sikandar Ali was in a business dispute with two other men who were jailed last year for their part in the plot. Amy Betrow was parked for 45 minutes before her gun became jammed. Hours later, she ordered a taxi with a fake name in audio heard in court.
Hi, can I get a taxi?
Okay, can I have your name?
Sahi.
Yeah. Where are you going to?
Sam Groves.
She'll be sentenced next week. European leaders have warned against Ukrainian borders being redrawn ahead of a meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin on Friday. In a statement, they said the people of Ukraine must have the freedom to decide their own future. The US president warned both sides may have to cede land to gain peace. Former Ukrainian ambassador to the EU, Konstantin Yezlevev, explains what he'd like to see.
Support the basic principle of the international law, territorial integrity, no compromise on grabbing land by force. At the same time, we do understand that peace must be brought to Ukraine and some compromises must be done.
An amber heat health alert is in effect across much of England, with temperatures set to reach 34 degrees, raising pressure on hospitals. The National Drought Group warns of nationally significant water shortages. Rachel Hallos is president of the National Farmers Union.
It is really mixed across the country. We have some areas where they're just about getting away with it. We're just about getting away with it on our farm. But in other parts of the country, it is really tough and they've not experienced this before.
The government's lined up an administrator for Thames Water if it can't secure a bailout from the private sector. FTI Consulting are being drafted in case Britain's largest water company collapses. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
4 minutes past three and a very good afternoon to you. I hope you're able to cope with the heat. And if it isn't hot, forgive us for going on about how hot it is if it isn't with you. Now, the Royal College of Nursing has urged the government to reverse the utterly abhorrent rise in violence against healthcare workers. Freedom of information requests by the RCN found more than 4,000 incidents of physical attacks on emergency staff in 2024, spread across 89 different trusts. The Royal College of Nursing is linking the attacks to conditions in the NHS, saying that reducing A&E waits for a start and ending corridor care and tackling chronic understaffing could all help to reduce the presumably febrile atmosphere that leads to the completely unacceptable idea of attacks on healthcare workers. Patricia Marquis is the Royal College of Nursing's Executive Director for England. Patricia Marquis, how long have you worked in healthcare?
So longer than I'd like to admit, if I'm perfectly honest. So since 1983, myself as a nurse.
Right.
I started as a student back then.
Now, I imagine that the uncomfortable truth is that there have always been occasions when healthcare workers of one sort or another were attacked in some way. Has it ever happened to you?
So I think whilst it's always been accepted that there is some degree of physical aggression, etc. So I recall when I first started my first shift in the emergency department, it was actually a New Year's Eve in Blackpool, which is where I was originally from. And it was certainly an atmosphere that was fueled, as you can imagine, on a New Year's Eve with alcohol and things. But it was pretty rare, to be honest, for people to be attacked in the way that we now see on a regular basis. There may be verbal aggression, there may be threats made, but in terms of actual attacks, that was unusual and has certainly grown exponentially in the last few years.
So by attack here, we are talking about physical violence, are we?
We are. We are talking about people being punched, being held against a wall by their throat, being thrown to the floor, knocked unconscious, and threatened with things like acid attacks, that sort of thing. So quite significant attacks, not just verbal sort of abuse, but actual physical violence towards healthcare staff in the emergency department. And I would add, whilst the recent Freedom of Information request was specifically around emergency departments. We do know that our members across the whole sector are also reporting rises in verbal and physical aggression to them in wards and other departments too.
Right. Can you tell us, is this violence, is the abuse coming from relatives in some cases, or is it more often likely to be the patient themselves?
It's a mixture of both. It is primarily the patients, but often in the emergency department, it may have an element of drugs or alcohol, but we absolutely are clear that a really significant contributing factor is the fact that our departments, emergency departments, are full to overflowing much of the time, with people waiting far too long to be seen and to be assessed. So the frustration and the irritation is just mounting and mounting and mounting, with people in inappropriate spaces, corridors, cupboards, etc. It all just comes together to create an atmosphere where it's taken out on the staff. The frustration is taken out on the staff.
Okay, so you are unashamedly linking understaffing, under-resourcing of the NHS with the greater chance of a member of NHS staff being abused in some way.
We absolutely are. We wouldn't shy away from the fact there are other contributory factors. We can see a rise in violence in other places and aggression towards other staff. But we're pretty clear from the feedback we get from our members, the feedback we get from employers, that a lot of it is around frustration and having to wait in departments that are not really conducive to people who are feeling, you know, ill and need treatment. Waiting a long time just adds and adds and adds. And the same is true on wards when people have waited for such a long time to get the treatment or the surgery. Their frustration is just taken out on staff.
Can I just put a couple of points from listeners to you, Patricia, if you don't mind? Dale just says, could you ask your guest whether there's any real data on the breakdown of the people who are carrying out these attacks? So I don't know quite what information Dale's after, but I mean, it is a worthwhile question, I suppose, to ask. Is it mainly men doing this? Is it mainly women? Is it people under the age of 60? Is there an answer to that?
I don't have that information. We didn't ask that as part of our Freedom of Information. Some of that will exist within the system, I've no doubt, but I don't want to speculate on what it is. I think the facts are that it's across the board, it's across all organisations, north, south, east and west, this symptom of increased violence towards staff. And for us, it's not the perpetrators that are the issue, it's the reasons that are the big issue that we want the government to deal with.
OK, another listener just says, if a patient gets violent with medical staff, then they should simply refuse to treat them. The problem is, Patricia, it's not that simple, is it?
No, it isn't that simple. You know, many of these people do need care and treatment, and it's not within medical or nursing staff's nature to walk away from people who need their help. We do have guidance that if things escalate to the point where staff feel absolutely unsafe and that there is a danger to them, they should be able to refuse to treat. But that would not be the first port of call. And that's why our message both to trusts and to the government is, look at the underlying reasons and deal with that. The more sticking plasters we put over this, the more it fails to deal with the underlying issue.
Right, well, what are the RCN solutions?
So it is about looking at more staff, valuing the staff, paying them properly, making sure they're working in the right place. So we can see that some of this is generated by underfunding in general practice, in community, in mental health services.
Right.
So it's about really looking at what the 10-year plan, in fact, is saying. We need to make that shift. We need to make the shift to public health, to improve health, out into communities and out into primary care, and to work across the system. Don't just focus on emergency departments. Really think about what the knock-on impact of not having the right staff in the right place is doing. So it is the direction of travel, but we need it to come quicker and we need it to come with more money attached to it in basic terms.
Right. And does that mean emphatically that nurses need a pay rise and they need it quickly?
I'm absolutely going to say that. We know our profession is really suffering. Morale is at rock bottom. Our pay has slipped further and further behind. And nurses are struggling to get the recognition for the jobs that they do. The staff in emergency departments will often still be people on the bottom of their pay scale and will have been there for many, many years. It isn't right. We need to value what these teams are doing, and we need to make sure that their pay reflects the responsibilities that they have.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but I mean, give people an idea. Let's say I am an experienced. Let's say I'm a staff nurse and I'm doing a night shift in A&E tonight in a major northern city. Let's say Blackpool. How much am I earning a year?
Probably around £40,000 with your unsocial hour payments if you're doing night shifts. Maybe a bit less than that, maybe maximum £37,000. It just varies slightly. But it's that comes with years of experience and really trying to deal with some of the most complex situations, both for individuals and the risks associated with caring from departments that might have hundreds of people in them at one go.
Does the public actually have a role to play here? And I'm thinking particularly in terms of A&E. Too many people go to A&E for stupid reasons. Now, if they stop doing that, that at least would be moderately helpful, wouldn't it?
Well, that's one of the things that the government and NHS leaders need to really think about is why are people doing that? We would never say it's stupid. There are reasons not to go to an emergency department and to, if you need treatment, to go to a whole range of other ones. We know what they are, pharmacies, minor injuries units, your GP, all of those things. But often people present at the emergency department because it feels like the only option they've got. So there is work to do, definitely, for the public to understand where's the right place to go for whatever it is that's, you know, wrong with them. But that, I think, again, goes back to this issue. Often people are frustrated. They've waited on a call to 111 for a response back for 3, 4, 5 hours. Mm. They get desperate. They go to where they know is going to be open 24/7, and that's often the emergency department.
Right. Will says, I just think it's very sad that the bad behaviour towards members of staff in the NHS is being blamed on members not being paid enough and not on the personal responsibility by the perpetrators. Well, I mean, that's not quite what you're saying, Patricia. You're just saying that if the NHS wants to retain good and experienced staff, then they're going to have to cough up. But nevertheless, there is a degree of personal responsibility here. I mean, many of us have been under severe stress in a hospital or in a GP surgery. We would never dream of abusing verbally or in any way being violent towards a member of staff. It just wouldn't happen. 90%, 95% of the British population wouldn't do such a thing.
No, absolutely. And to be clear, I absolutely agree. I'm not saying that it's about the salaries that's the root of the problem, but it contributes to why we've got people concentrated in an area where, you know, if you're waiting 12, 13, 14, 15 hours to be seen in an emergency department surrounded by unwell people, not feeling well yourself. Those are the things that contribute. But yes, absolutely. We would ask the public to be mindful. It's so sad to go into an emergency department, and the first thing you see in a number of departments now are huge posters and you know, saying violence will not be tolerated. We shouldn't have to do that as a society. Absolutely not.
No, I agree with you. Reality. It's so grim. And you see those posters, by the way, in things like postal sorting offices as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just utterly ridiculous. You're quite right. It's just worth saying we've got a message here from Frank. He says, I was driving a taxi in Liverpool back in the 70s. I took a young nurse to the Southern Hospital on a Friday night, and she complained to me about the likelihood of violence on that shift. I don't think anything has changed, says Frank. So it has always been a problem.
Yeah, no, I would agree. A former colleague of mine messaged me earlier today saying she'd done a dissertation back in the 90s on exactly this issue. But she also said it has got worse. What were reported then was much more violent, verbal aggression and not acceptable, but low level violence, usually fueled by drugs or alcohol. And often, you know, with patients who are not necessarily feeling mentally well themselves. That's what's changed. This is now happening every hour across England, a nurse or somebody in the emergency department is being attacked, and they are very serious attacks. They're not just a, you know, verbal aggression.
No.
They are people being punched, thrown to the ground, you know, that sort of thing.
No, that's clearly
not with PTSD.
Yes,
as a result.
It's utterly indefensible. I mean, would it be economically viable to have psychiatric A&Es? Have we ever had them?
So many units have got nurses with psychiatric training and education in them. There are separate units available, and it is one of the things that is being suggested as a way forward for the future. And we would certainly support that. There is definitely a place to ensure that people who've got different needs have got access to different sorts of services in those hours of need. So, yes, we do think that that's a good way forward and is something that could help to reduce. But often at the minute, it is space, it is time, it is crowded, it is people being in inappropriate places when they're trying to get the care they need.
And just very briefly, we've talked about pay. RCN members in England and Wales have rejected the government's pay offer, 3.6%. So is a strike a real possibility over the coming months?
Look, we want to do everything we can to avoid a strike. So do the government. What the government needs to do is get round the table to negotiate. There's recommendations been made that is what they should do by the pay review body. They've committed to do that. We look forward to those negotiations taking place as soon as possible to avoid any potential escalation. Nurses don't want it. We don't believe the public want it. We think there is a way of avoiding that, and we look forward to those talks starting with the government as soon as possible.
Thank you very much. That's Patricia Marquis, who's the Royal College of Nursing Executive Director for England. And I'm glad that we actually got that figure from Patricia about what an experienced nurse, a staff nurse, might be earning if she were working in an A&E unit in the north of England. She'd probably be on, according to Patricia, between about 37, or he, of course, about 37 to 40 grand. When you think about it, it isn't a lot of money for a job that can be, to put it mildly, stressful. And it's so hugely important, of course. Let me know what you think. It is 0333 003 2353. My big guest this afternoon is the actress and novelist Celia Imrie. She's very successful at both. There is a new, she will feature as our big guest on Off Air, the podcast with Jane and Fee, which drops at about 6 o'clock Monday to Thursday, and which this week is actually involving Jane Mulkerins, our brilliant colleague from The Times. She's associate editor of The Times magazine. She's very good value, is Jane. She lives in Brighton, so she's a little bit alternative. But she's always got a lot to say. Fee is off. She is very much back next week. So today, Jane and I have been talking about all sorts of things. Allotments, pornography, careers advice. It's all in the edition of Off Air that comes your way at six tonight. It's worth saying that all of our 3:30 interviews appear in Off Air, and we've had some real good ones lately. Gary Newman, Janet Street Porter, Max Hastings was excellent. And last week, Fee talked to the Irish actor Adrian Dunbar, known for Line of Duty and Ridley. And recently, he took his daughter to see the group Kneecap. Fee asked him if the BBC had been wrong not to stream their Glastonbury performance.
Were they wrong not to stream it? I don't know. I think that's a question for the BBC, not for me. But I do think that everybody got too heated about them. You know, I think everybody jumped to conclusions about them. I think, I think they're a band. They're good musicians. They make great music. They're promoting the Irish language. They're very clear about who they support and who they don't support. And, we had a great time there. But, you know, those decisions are for the BBC.
That is the big guest from a couple of weeks ago now. Was it the week before last? Was it last week? Adrian Dunbar, brilliant actor, part of Off Air. He was in conversation there with Fee. So you can download that episode of Off Air and indeed 47 billion trillion others wherever you get your podcasts from. Tomorrow's guest here on the afternoon programme and indeed on Off Air as well will be the former First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon. You may well have already consumed some of the publicity and pre-publicity publicity about her memoir, frankly. And all I'll say is that she is, to be fair to the woman, she's extremely frank in that book. I hope there are some interesting bits of the interview. I've just been re-listening to the Nicola Sturgeon conversation. And she does talk a lot about her relationship with Alex Salmond and about what it's like to be a woman in politics. And there were some men in politics, perhaps surprisingly, that she really got on with. Notably, she has good things to say about Martin McGuinness and David Cameron. A fairly unusual duo, you've got to say. And she also got on with Prince Philip when they would meet at Balmoral. So if you think you know what you think about Nicola Sturgeon, and I think I know that lots of people have very strong views on her, you may have your view slightly altered if you listen to the conversation tomorrow afternoon here on Times Radio. Now, Ukraine has claimed a possible Russian breakthrough in the east is less serious than feared. It had been reported that Russian infantry had got behind Ukrainian front lines, with elite units being rushed to attempt to contain them. Let's have a word with Tom Much, who is a freelance war correspondent based in Ukraine. So what was thought to have happened, Tom, and what do we now believe has actually happened?
OK, so to set the scene, there's a mapping service called Deep State, which is basically done by a group of Ukrainian volunteers with strong connections in the military. Mm-hmm. And last night they posted a map update that showed that Russia had taken this enormous, well, not enormous, but like quite large chunk of territory, about 16 kilometres in just over a day or two, and everything went absolutely haywire. And one of the problems is that we don't know at this stage how many Russian troops got there. Is this just a small advance party that got cut off, or have the Russians been able to exploit this into a larger breakthrough where they've rushed soldiers and armor into this small breach that they have? And so it could be anything from catastrophic to actually a fairly minor incursion that will be sort of brushed off. There was one of these a couple of months ago in the town of Kupiansk in the north that was brushed off quite quickly. But the reason people are worried about this is that Ukrainian defenses in this part of the line have been under severe stress for a while. And also, this is really, really crucial because it has a lot of political significance as well. If the Russians really have made some kind of breakthrough into Ukrainian lines, it means that Vladimir Putin can go to Alaska on Friday and say, hey, I'm winning this war. The territory I want, I'm either going to take it on the negotiating table or I'm going to take it on the military, on the battlefield.
Well, obviously, we are looking ahead to events in Alaska on Friday and the meeting between Presidents Trump and Putin. The fact that this timing of this supposed Russian breakthrough happens to have been in the last 24 hours, doesn't it make you suspicious slightly that it may not be true or it's been exaggerated?
What I think is quite likely is that the Russians have accumulated reserves and combat power for a moment like now, when there is a major negotiation about to take place. If you look back into 2014, during the Minsk agreements, the Russians often timed their assaults, along with their Donbass allies, proxies, to coincide with major meetings between Ukrainian leadership and the Europeans and Putin back then. So it could very well be that Russia has basically made a very, very fast, however unsustainable, advance that is basically being made for political rather than military purposes. That doesn't mean it isn't very, very concerning for people on the ground and in Ukraine to see Russian forces 15 kilometres over where they were supposed to be just this weekend.
What is the mood, if it's possible to generalise, about these talks in Alaska?
I think there's some hope, but it's fairly faint. So one of the problems is that I don't think a lot of people in Ukraine see Donald Trump as an actor that necessarily has their best interests at heart. So one of the things is that he does seem at least sincere in his desire that he wants this war to stop, but he doesn't seem to understand the Ukrainian position and why they don't want to give up more land, and especially why they think they need security guarantees. So a big point of contention has been the fact that Donald Trump has said oh, any agreement that Putin makes with me, he'll keep because he respects and understands me and I'm the US president. I have all his firepower at my backing. However, the Ukrainians are like, well, last time, you know, we pulled our punches. We didn't fight for Crimea in 2014. And so why would we give up more territory now that might just be used again for another attack in 8 years' time?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem to the outsider that Putin has moved one iota. He hasn't budged an inch, has he? He still doesn't believe that Ukraine is a real country, and he's not prepared to change his attitude towards it. I mean, it's just, it's very hard to see anything other than bad news coming out of the summit on Friday if you're Ukrainian. But, I mean, do you think I'm unduly pessimistic?
The only way that a really positive outcome happens, and I don't discount this possibility because Donald Trump's stance on this has changed and has been fairly unpredictable, is that Donald Trump effectively calls Putin's bluff. He realizes that the demand that Putin has that Ukraine give up all this extra territory is nonsense, and he decides to then arm Ukraine to the hilt and impose the secondary sanctions he's been threatening. I don't think it's likely, but it's not out of the realms of possibility. Mm. But one of the things that I think, and this recent Russian breach of the Ukrainian lines does show, is that the Russians still have the economic capacity and they still have the military capability to, if not destroy Ukraine's position, at least keep pressing and at least keep taking more territory. And I think most analysts reckon they've got at least a year left of that kind of capability sort of in their back pocket. So why not use it and then come to the negotiating table in a year's time and take whatever offer is on the table then, once they're in a better position to do
right.
So.
I mean, there's also a possibility, I mean, you're right, of course, Donald Trump is so unpredictable, that Donald Trump feels he's not getting anywhere with President Putin. We know that many of Trump's supporters just don't want anything to do with arming Ukraine, and that Donald Trump says, oh, you know what, I've just had an absolute belly full of this. I can't win the Nobel Prize trying to sort this lot out, and just walks away, leaving Ukraine presumably completely dependent on help from Europe, which may not be forthcoming.
So I think it's important to step back a bit here and look at the timeline and that, okay, so look, at the end, you know, in 2022 and 2023, Ukraine was almost entirely reliant on US military aid. It has actually weaned itself off that dependence quite a lot, because a lot of the kills that Ukraine is getting are coming from sort of homegrown drone production industries. And these have become a very, very good stopgap for when, for instance, American support dried up at the end of 2023 with the issues that were going on in the US Congress then. So Ukraine is no longer reliant on its Western partners in a way that it was 2 years ago. The one case thing where this isn't the case is specifically Patriot batteries, Patriot missiles. Ukraine needs them, and it has nothing else that can stop Russian ballistic missiles hitting its city. But other than that, Ukraine is no longer as reliant on Western partners as it once was.
Thank you very much for that, Tom. Tom March, who's a freelance war correspondent based in Ukraine. And as I said earlier, obviously, you can rely on Times Radio for full coverage of whatever unfolds in Alaska at the end of the week. Next, our big interview today is with the brilliant actress Celia Imrie. She's also a novelist. She is genuinely multi-talented. She's a fascinating woman, and you can hear from her after the latest news headlines here on Times Radio, and they are from Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. More than 50,000 migrants have now arrived in the UK by small boat since Labour returned to power last July. It's despite Sir Keir Starmer's promise to smash people smuggling gangs behind the English Channel crossings and a new one-in, one-out returns deal with France. The Conservatives say it's the worst illegal immigration crisis in British history. Leader Kemi Badenoch has suggested housing asylum seekers in old army bases.
What worries me most is that the government will say they're taking people out of hotels and just put them into private accommodation, which will be even harder for us to track what's going on. And that's what really worries me now. Labour should not be doing that. They need to build proper places where we can put people coming to our country illegally.
A would-be US assassin who disguised herself in a niqab in a failed attempt to kill a Birmingham shopkeeper has been found guilty of conspiracy to murder. Amy Betrow, who's 45, flew to the UK and tried to shoot Sikandar Ali at point-blank range outside his home in 2019, but her gun jammed. A 31-year-old man and a 27-year-old woman have been arrested on suspicion of murder in connection with the death of a one-year-old baby on the Isle of Wight. Jailer Jean McLaren died in hospital earlier this month. Israel claims it doesn't target members of the press after four Al Jazeera journalists and a freelance reporter were killed in a strike. The Israeli military claims they were targeting prominent correspondent Anas al-Sharif because, they say, he led a terror cell, which he denied prior to his death. And Madonna has asked the Pope to visit Gaza because he's the only person in the world who can't be denied entry. She's asked Pope Leo to go before it's too late. And for News Bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
When you run a small business, you know it's important to keep an eye on your costs, and a smart meter can help. Aaron Sani's family own Twinkle Toes, the largest children's shoe retailer in Sheffield. He uses his smart meter to find ways to cut his energy costs.
Well, we chose to get a smart meter because what we didn't really know is what our daily consumption was. And so we just wanted to target, are there ways that we can actually go and see what we were using it on and that sort of thing. We have identified some areas where we've managed to save energy. The lights are used for 8 hours a day, so we can go and change the actual lighting to LED. And secondly, in the stockroom, for instance, if we introduce LED sensors, it will help reduce usage when no one's actually in the stockroom. Smart meter is a great tool. I would certainly recommend it to other businesses because it's certainly been a wonderful tool to help our business to actually understand our energy usage.
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter for Business. Eligibility may vary.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, Celia Imrie in a moment or two, but just a quick catch up with your messages. Anonymous says, why do nurses get the same pay regardless of what they do? My son is an intensive care nurse and it's constant there, yet others are in clinics doing not very much except weighing patients and filling forms. And see, this is a perk of the job. Many nurses work 3 days a week and are paid well above the national average salary. I don't know whether they're paid well above the national average salary, and certainly not if they're working only 3 days a week. But I take the point about your son. I do think being an intensive care nurse is one very particular role. And it may seem as though nurses in certain clinics are perhaps not exactly rushed off their feet, let's be honest. But again, do get involved. Let us know what you think. You can email the podcast as well or email the programme. It is janeandfee@times.radio. Kate says, I was in A&E recently with my daughter. I live in Dublin, I should say. And I did see all the warning signs and increased security. But on that occasion, all the staff, the patients and their accompanying advocates on a Sunday were getting on fine together. Well, Kate, that's good to know that things were working well in Dublin in A&E. And I hope your daughter's all right, actually. I'm sorry that you had to go with her to A&E over the weekend. Let's move on then to the big guest, who is Celia Imrie. And Celia's remarkable. She has the temerity to be a supremely gifted performer and a best-selling novelist. The paperback edition of Meet Me at Rainbow Corner, which is set in the Second World War, is out this week. She's also, of course, the star of great films like The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. But you, like me, might remember her most fondly as Babs, the proprietor of Victoria Woods's epic soap emporium, Acorn Antiques. Celia's also about to star in the Thursday Murder Club. That is the film adaptation of Richard Osman's best-selling book, of course. And Celia is going to compete in Celebrity Traitors, which is on telly in the autumn. She is a very, very busy woman. I asked her if she was enjoying it all.
Oh, I'm loving it. Yes, yeah. I couldn't be happier busy.
Yes. Is that your big dread, not to be busy?
It's a bit, actually. Yeah. I also love not knowing what's coming next.
Well, I'm going to ask you a sneaky old question later in the interview about what's coming next. But people will know that you've got a big Netflix event coming in a couple of weeks' time. But we want to also talk about your novel, which is out on Thursday in paperback.
Yes.
And in this dizzying heat, what could be more comforting than the idea of settling down with your novel? It is about World War II, so it's not entirely peaceful.
No, afraid it isn't.
It's called Meet Me at Rainbow Corner. And, well, you can tell us, first of all, about your fascination with this time in our history. I mean, lots of us are interested. And reading this, I wondered whether I was, and I've got to be careful how you phrase this, I was almost jealous that I wasn't around at the time.
I know exactly what you mean.
Do you? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, because the thing is, it's so really difficult to imagine, isn't it? It's like no other time, and very hard for us too, because they really did go to bed and wake up wondering if they'd still be alive the next day. But it was so heartening to realise that everybody pulled together, everybody did their bit. And the bulk of this beginning of this story, Meet Me at Rainbow Corner, is really from Fidelis Morgan, who collaborates on the book with me in a huge way, from her mother's letters.
Well, I could not believe the story of this lady, Fidelis's mum. Tell everybody about her.
Well, she's also Fidelis Morgan. That's her name. She was 17. She was a Red Cross nurse, and she couldn't wait to join up, which it seems lots of people of that age were so keen. And lots of people lost their lives. This is and she tells stories of heartbreaking things she had to deal with as a nurse. You know, young boys of 17 who'd lost their arms, who'd lost their legs, but they had a great spirit and they were looking forward to their holiday. Fidelis reads out some of the letters when we do an event in the theatre, and honestly, it cracks you up.
Well, I had no idea. The level of suffering. So Fidelis's mother, also called Fidelis
Morgan.
Yeah. Which is in itself fantastic, by the way.
Yes.
She lost three separate fiancés, three different young men died.
They all fell in love with her because she was an absolute beauty. But yes, and they were all young. And yes, one after the other, I'm afraid, by the end of the war, all dead. So actually, it was very hard for her when victory was announced, because actually it was probably, and I think I'm right in saying, the same day as she got yet another letter with a blue cross on the envelope, returned to sender, and the person deceased. And it was a miserable way of finding out.
That's really brutal, isn't it?
Isn't it? Or otherwise you'd get a very formal letter from the War Office, you know, saying, very sorry to hear, our condolences, you know, ghastly. But we, you know, what they lived through. But there is joy as well as heartache and huge courage.
Yes, well, that's what I was going to say. We must never, ever forget the suffering and the loss. But it sounds intoxicating.
I know.
And at the heart of this novel is the friendship between two very, very different women. And that's the other thing that struck me about this time, was that the classes mixed. People met people they would never, ever have come across. And actually, it changed the country forever, didn't it?
It's true. Dot, one of our heroes, is based on Fidelis's mum. She is a nurse from Liverpool. She knows all the American music, so she's the most perfect choice when she is persuaded by her sister at the hospital to go and volunteer as a dance partner in Rainbow Corner.
Which is a club for...
Well, yes. It was right in the heart of Piccadilly Circus. Rainbow Corner was especially invented for the GIs who came over to help us. It was an extraordinary place. It had no rationing, so they were treated like gods, really, with 24-hour donuts.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that they had a donut machine.
Yes. So you can imagine the smell as you go in.
Yeah, yeah.
They also had a wonderful welcome map of America at the reception, so that you could arrive and put your little red pin wherever in the map you came from, and so if you saw another person from Wisconsin, you would seek them out,
right,
and you would find each other. But and then they had Fred Astaire's sister was on the desk, and lot of people came over and volunteered. It was a hive of activity and a glorious place. Mm. And the dancing is very important, actually, because, of course, the Americans, they didn't want to foxtrot and waltz. They wanted to go mad and have Count Basie and, you know, the jitterbug music going on, which was very joyful and kept them going.
Then they needed suitable dance companions. And what I didn't know, I learned a lot from this actually, was that young women, young British women, suitable, would be plucked and actually more or less ordered to become their dance partners.
Yes, yeah. Well, certainly in the story, Dot's sister on the ward said, "What do you do in your spare time? I think you should go along to Rainbow Corner and volunteer yourself." And that's how she met her boyfriend. Lily, the other heroine, is loosely based on my mother, a bit posher, coming from Hampshire. She used to drive ambulances in the war, like the Queen, and my mother played the violin to the troops. But yes, those two women, people describe them as extraordinary. They were extraordinary because of what they did, but actually they were quite ordinary. But as you quite rightly said, they could well not have met in their social lives. But they come together. They both have individual paths during the war and come together a little bit, you know, every now and again. But it is to try to imagine what it was like in those days. I hope from the research that Fidelis has done and from the letters, we've managed to paint as realistic a picture as we can.
Yeah, because not everybody was on side. I mean, there were, and we forget this at our peril, there were Nazi sympathisers in Britain at some very senior levels, actually.
I know, it's horrifying, isn't
it? Well, it is horrifying, and we do need to be reminded of that, I think, sometimes.
I know. And the domestic spies we discovered, not necessarily high level, but, I mean, there's a housewife on the Isle of Wight, true story, and she used to deliver information as far up as she could to let the Germans know where the troops were going. I mean, it's quite an intricate operation going on, and they were being listened to, you know, because there was a wonderful man who encouraged them to come forward with all their information. And then, of course, they thought he was passing it on to the Germans. Of course, he wasn't.
He wasn't. No. Yeah. Well, thank goodness he wasn't. Mm. It's an amazing chunk of World War II experience, which I didn't know about. And then it's worth saying, too, that some of the British women who went over to America were so-called GI brides.
Yes.
They didn't have the easiest time either, did they?
No. Well, for a start, they had to... There's a very poignant thing I read about how they all had to say goodbye to their mothers and fathers on Waterloo Station. And the mothers and fathers were not allowed to come any further. Then they went to Tidworth Camp, and that was pretty grim, having their passports and, you know... And, of course, quite a lot of them had little young children by then and hadn't seen their fiancés or husbands for about a year. Then they had the whole trip across the ocean, which some didn't take to very well. And then, if you can imagine, the smell of nappies and everything, you know.
Yes.
But then they get to New York, and I'm afraid to say some husbands weren't there. Some had decided, did I get married over in England? I don't remember that bit. So, poor darlings, it didn't all go well. And then they had the huge, great journey across America, which I've done, actually, on the trains. It's a wonderful journey. But they didn't know what they were going to. They hadn't met their husband's parents, who might not take kindly to them. I mean, the things I've read, well, we've taken real stories and put into the book, because, you know, hopefully some were marvelous. marvellous ending,
yeah, sure.
But
yeah.
Not all.
No, and that's always worth bearing in mind. You are, of course, known, I was going to say, mainly for your acting. I hope you don't mind me saying that.
No, of course not.
You've had great success with your books, I should say, but your acting is of a huge significance, actually. I really want to talk about Victoria Wood, and actually, by pure coincidence, brilliantly, there is a whole evening dedicated to her on BBC Four tonight.
Gosh.
I know. Did you know that?
I did not.
Okay, 9 o'clock tonight on BBC Four. So they're showing, I think, her favourite bits, her favourite sketches.
Oh, lovely.
Starting at nine. So if anybody's a fan, they obviously will know you as Babs in Hapless Owner of Acorn Antiques. I don't think I'm the only woman of my age who really misses Victoria Wood.
Just, oh, no, of course not.
And you obviously knew her.
Yes.
But just how significant was she in your life?
Well, huge, really. I mean, I will be forever grateful to her because, you know, she, I would say, you know, put me on the map in the comedy world, I suppose, which I love. And also she was very generous, first of all, giving away such brilliant lines that she wrote, but also gathering a little team together. We weren't very many of us, but it made a huge difference because when we came back each season, we knew each other, we could work much faster, we knew how Victoria worked, and she was extremely strict, quite rightly, because she wrote like music, so it had to be everything was completely...
Every beat.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely, punctuation, word. But it was great because we met up again and again, and it meant it was a wonderful way of working because we all had fun, trusted each other. But it was tough. I mean, lots of it we never did in front of an audience because, you know, the discipline of, well, keeping a straight face for me generally.
Was hard.
I mean, yes.
Well, Acorn Antiques. I mean, you didn't have to have watched Crossroads to enjoy Acorn Antiques, but if you, like me, had watched Crossroads and then
you saw the similarity.
Well, it's just brilliant.
Well, I'm based on Noel Gordon, of course.
Of course,
yes. And poor Miss Babs, she did try, but it was no good when she picked up the telephone and it started still ringing.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. She never got that right, did she?
None of her customers ever bought a thing.
No. Did Acorn Antiques go bust in the end? It must have done.
Must have done.
Yeah.
Same two customers, if you watch carefully.
Yeah.
Same husband and wife.
Yeah.
They never bought a thing.
Well, if you do know more about what happened to Acorn Antiques, please do feel free to contact Times Radio or the podcast. But just to alert people, if they have the BBC at home, they can enjoy that tonight and on their other facilities. Now, you are also starring in the Thursday Murder Club, your Joyce. I was a bit surprised. It's not going to cinemas, or will it at some point? It's going straight to Netflix.
No. I think there's going to be one precious week in the cinema.
Right.
Which is glorious. And maybe it might last a bit longer, I don't know. But anyway, I think it'll be worth seeing on the big screen. Certainly.
Yeah, well, this is just in case anybody doesn't know, this is the film adaptation of the Richard Osman book. Remind us who Joyce is, the character that you play.
Well, she's the new girl in the group. She's an ex-nurse. Luckily, I've got two angels, sisters, in my life, who helped me with all the sort of how the training was, and I watched them growing up, you know.
So your actual sisters?
Actual sisters.
Right.
Are both nurses.
Right.
So I remember their training, and I was on the telephone to ask them any more hints that I could get. But Joyce is, at the beginning of the book, very much the new girl. And so that I had to pretend I didn't know Dame Helen, or didn't know Piers. We've all worked together before. I hadn't worked with Sir Ben Kingsley, but it was quite fun pretending not to know each other, if you see what I mean.
Yes, okay. I mean, it's just quite the cast you got there.
I know.
Do you think that you would actually get on well in sheltered housing later life?
No, I don't.
What?
Sorry, I'm allowed to say I'm going to get in such trouble.
Why does it not appeal to you?
I don't know. Well, actually, I mean, look, when you see it, it's absolute luxury. It really is. Beautiful grounds and everything. I don't know. I think really and truly it's because I still think I'm 26. So I think that day is never going to come. But I'm sure I'd be very grateful if I was looked after, of course. But I sort of pretend that's not happening. I you know, I don't want to look that far at the moment.
Have you always had this attitude?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how old you are, so I'm not... Okay, so...
Well, everybody else asks, but anyway, I never lie, but, you know, it's childish, really, of me, I know. But in terms of... You'll see in the film, in terms of, you know, a place to go in later life, this couldn't be more luxurious, truly.
Well, except the murder rate is
Ah, yes, that's a bit of a problem.
But we wouldn't have a film without it. So.
Well, no, except I don't think... They don't... Oh, no, they do... Okay, I'm not going to tell any more because I don't want to spoil it.
Who do you... Of the other cast members, Pierce Brosnan, Ben Kingsley, Helen Mirren, who do you think would succeed and would perhaps become social secretary at a sheltered housing complex whenever they are anywhere near old enough to enter one?
Well, actually, I mean, they do pretty well... all of us do pretty well once we're there. But, I mean, I suspect that in real life, if I can say that, there probably aren't quite such adventurous things going on. I mean, it is...
Well, let's hope there aren't.
No, quite. So, you know, but I think they do pretty well. As a team, we do pretty well.
Isn't there... there is a kind of retirement home for older performers, isn't there?
Yes, Denville Hall.
Yeah, which it's actually hugely important because not everybody makes a vast living, do they?
No, it's wonderful. And they have, you know, new wings being built, you know, annually, actually. No, it's a marvellous place. It really is. And... it's good to know that, you know, there is a place where people can tell their theatrical stories and, you know, have a good time, I hope.
Do you think that will... you're nowhere near your dotage, but when you are in it... I mean, I'm going to bore to tears anyone who has the misfortune to share any kind of property with me as I enter my 10th decade about my glittering life in radio. So why shouldn't you... You've got much better stories than me. Why shouldn't you tell your tales to people, to an avid audience?
I think that it would make people happy to share them. I think it's a lovely place to be, as I understand.
Do you have an absolute knockout showbiz anecdote?
Oh, Lord.
You don't have to. Have
probably.
One.
But you see, I'll get myself into trouble. You can't imagine. I already have. So I better not. I'll save it for... when we're off the air, you and I. Okay? That's intriguing, isn't it?
Yes. Let's leave sheltered housing behind and think of a deserted mansion in the middle of the Scottish countryside, where I understand, Celia, you are going to be spending some time. Now, what's this?
Ah, well, you think I'm going to tell you? Bad luck. I'm not. I'm not going to say a word, but gosh, I had a good time.
Well, we've talked about traitors in World War II. The least you can do is feed me a tidbit about what you were up to.
Well, you know what... Inverness is famous for. You know that big castle that everybody knows. Perhaps you didn't know I was up there. But anyway, I was with a selection of people who, I think people know who else I was with. And I had a wonderful time, but that's all I'm going to tell you.
Were you there a long time or only a short time?
I'm not going to tell you. Good try.
Did you meet anyone nice?
Maybe.
Right, okay, we'll just have to wait. Celia Imrie, thank you through gritted teeth. Thank you very much for limited information about this forthcoming edition of Celebrity Traitors.
Thank you.
Celia Imrie, who, I mean, she has signed a contract that means that she can't talk about Celebrity Traitors, which is why she didn't, but she was lovely. And the paperback edition of her novel, Meet Me at Rainbow Corner, I'm clutching a copy in my hand now, is out on Thursday. And it's an interesting read, actually. Simon says, Celia says, Tidworth Camp was grim. Sorry to disappoint, but it still is. Sounds like he's somebody with bitter experience. Now, tomorrow at about 3:30, you can hear my interview with Nicola Sturgeon, the former First Minister of Scotland, of course. We certainly discuss what it was like when her husband was arrested. Actually, it's an incredible account that she just had to ring her mum and dad and go and stay with them, which must have been quite the phone call. She talks too about the rise of reform in Scotland, why Boris Johnson could never have succeeded if he'd been a woman. And she talks too about her relationship with Alex Salmond.
I've tried not to rewrite history. He was my mentor. He was a very close friend. We were in you know, it's for others to judge. But I would say we were one of the most successful political partnerships in recent British political history. So a lot of my successes, not all of them, but a lot of them, he is integrally involved in and you know, deserves the credit as much as I do. But he was a tough person to work for. That's not a fault in itself. And particularly in our years in government, he would sometimes leave the heavy lifting of government.
Well, he left the heavy lifting to you. That was
Yes, I mean, there's more to that conversation. And yes, that was particular extract was about Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon, how they got on, why she was... why he was so important to her. And of course, it all ended very, very badly. Alex Salmond is dead now, which is probably why we can be much more honest about what he was actually like. Anyway, it's Times Radio. It's 4 minutes to four.
Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
What is the future for net zero? The chief executive of Octopus Energy, Greg Jackson, will talk to us about how it's affecting all of our bills.
Also, what is the difference between legal and illegal immigration? And who's coming in and who's leaving the country? We're going to be crunching the numbers.
And the former Conservative Minister, Edwina Curry, will be joined by the Times data reporter, Joey Durso, to talk us through the news of the day from 9.
Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio. Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Ah, claim approved. Direct Line's ready to send my new laptop within 2 hours. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like teaching little Johnny to play his recorder.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Theft and accidental loss claims up to £3,000. Cover limits apply. Personal possessions cover needed for items outside the home.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today and discover why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Learn more at viking.com.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as SAINTS, could help. SAINTS has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. SAINTS is managed by Baillie Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
This is Times Radio.
Fine, it's never happened to me in my broadcasting career, which has gone on now for hundreds of years. I've had a message from Chipping Norton. I mean, this is just brilliant. It's about someone called Peter. Peter is just losing his rag, Callum MacDonald, about J.D. Vance's visit.
Gosh.
Quite a detailed WhatsApp, so I'll leave it to you to read that one out. But it's he does say, I don't know if this subject has been raised yet. Peter, we have a reporter following J.D. Vance around the Cotswolds. I talked to him at about 20 past two. Where were you? Anyway, what's this? I just want to end with Scott, who says, I like to think that since Acorn Antiques went bankrupt, it became a health spa run by Bertha, with Mrs. Overall as the beautician, offering her signature rich tea facial and a macaroon foot soak. Thank you. That's Scott. Scott says he loves Celia. Yes, Celia Imrie was our guest a little bit earlier. I hope you didn't miss that. If you did, it's in Off Air with Jane and Jane, which comes your way at about 6 o'clock tonight. Callum is next. Thanks to Felix Forbes, Anthony Cheng, Eve Salisbury, technical operator Ryan Boyden. Enjoy the programme, Callum. Have a good evening.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thanks, Jane. Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. This is Callum McDonald in for John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. The headlines: more than 50,000 migrants have now arrived in the UK by small boat since Labour came to power last July. And European leaders are warning against Ukrainian borders being redrawn ahead of that meeting between President Trump and Vladimir Putin on Friday. Coming up on Times Radio Drive, as the jobs market here cools, but the threats of conflict abroad heat up, do politicians need to get real about a fundamental change in the future of our economy and convince voters that defence and security are now national aims? We'll discuss that with the National Institute of Economic and Social Research and the trade body for the UK's defence industries. We've also got a former director for the National Security Council under President Obama looking ahead to that summit in Alaska. And what are the next steps for Thames Water as ministers line up an administrator?
This is Times Radio.
Right now, the latest news. Here's Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. More than 50,000 migrants have now arrived in the UK by small boat since Labour returned to power last July. It's despite Keir Starmer's promise to smash people smuggling gangs behind the English Channel crossings and a new one-in, one-out returns deal with France. The Conservatives say it's the worst illegal immigration crisis in British history. Oliver Wright is policy editor at The Times and says these numbers are likely to grab people's attention.
The other number, although it's not directly comparable with today, is that in the first half of this year, the number of people arriving in the UK via small boats was 48% higher than it has been in the same period last year. Now, clearly there is an issue about things like the weather. Most people would say that the weather in this part of the year has been better than the previous year, so that can slightly skew the figures. But nevertheless, for the government, which came in pledging to smash the gangs, these are not good statistics.
People claiming universal credit in the UK has hit a record high, has jumped by more than a million in a year from 6.9 million people last July to 8 million last month. The rise has been driven by people who are not required to work, like those in full-time education or considered to have no prospect of work. Reem Ibrahim is from the Institute of Economic Affairs.
It's absolutely abysmal. And what this really does show is the amount of money that we are now spending as taxpayers on people that are now not working. But if we zoom out, there are 21% of 16 to 64 year olds that are economically inactive. That is absolutely outrageous.
Labour government has previously said it inherited a broken welfare system and is working on reforms. An American woman behind a failed assassination attempt in Birmingham has been found guilty of conspiracy to murder. Amy Betrow attempted to shoot Sikandar Ali outside his home in September 2019, but the gun jammed, allowing him to flee. Hannah Sidaway from the Crown Prosecution Service says the 45-year-old was extradited from Armenia earlier this year.
Particular arrangements are required for any extradition application, so it's a very complex process that not only has to conform with UK law, but also the particular policies and laws of the Armenian authorities.
Two men have already been jailed for their part in the plot. A 31-year-old man and a 27-year-old woman have been arrested on suspicion of murder in connection with the death of a one-year-old baby on the Isle of Wight. Jailer Jean McLaren died in hospital earlier this month. The Israeli military claims they don't target journalists after five reporters were killed in an airstrike on a tent where press were sheltering. Among them was well-known Al Jazeera correspondent Anas al-Sharif, who Israel claims was the leader of a Hamas cell. That accusation has been rejected by his employer and human rights organisations. IDF spokesman Nadav Shoshani has implied Israel might release more information about the other journalists killed.
There's a process of us of declassification, of verification, and I want to be very responsible, and I'll just say that we're looking into further details of the additional people and further details of this strike.
An administrator has been arranged for Thames Water in case it fails to secure a bailout. The water supplier is in £20 billion worth of debt and a previous rescue deal fell through. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker.
Times Radio Drive with Barclays Business Banking.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 minutes past four on Tuesday afternoon, the 12th of August. Welcome to Times Radio Drive. This is Callum MacDonald here while John Pienaar's on holiday. Thank you very much for being with us. Defence plants from Germany to Hungary are expanding at triple the pace they did just 4 years ago. Vast new assembly halls stretching over a combined 2.8 million square metres are being built to churn out shells and missiles and drones. It's the kind of industrial muscle not seen in the continent of Europe since the Cold War. The EU's 500 million euro ammunition programme, NATO's multi-billion dollar missile contract and national subsidies are fueling what some are calling a new war economy. But while the cranes and conveyor belts gather speed in Europe's defence sector, the latest data here in the UK suggests that the labour market is cooling. Vacancies have fallen for the 37th month in a row, and wage growth, while still above inflation, is losing steam. For policymakers, then, a stark contrast. Europe doubles down on military production. Britain grapples with softer job numbers. Although the UK will be building 7,000 long-range missiles and at least six new factories to produce ammunition and material for explosives after that recent strategic defence review returned to the government, a former director of NATO Arms Control tells Times Radio Drive this afternoon that 2024 was the most electrifying year for changes in defence. And he'll tell us whether he thinks President Trump has proved to be more effective than the NATO alliance at inspiring rearmament. And what does this chapter tell us about the future? What does a continent gearing up for sustained arms production mean for economies under strain? Can a surge in defence manufacturing offset slowdown and bring us growth? Or does it risk pulling skilled workers and resources away from other industries? And how can Europe balance being ready for conflict with the need, of course, to sustain peace? Welcome to Times Radio Drive. I'm Callum MacDonald. Also coming up on the programme this afternoon, H.R. McMaster, former National Security Advisor to President Trump, evaluates the world's battlefields for us at 4:45. And a Democratic member of the Alaska Senate looks forward to the Trump-Putin summit, which has made Alaska the centre of the world. You can text us this afternoon, and please do. The number is 87222. Start your message with the word Times, or email studio@times.radio, or you can WhatsApp, and the number there is 0333 003 2353. Let's begin then with official figures which show the UK labour market is cooling down following pressure from the Chancellor Rachel Reeves's higher payroll taxes. Data shows that average weekly earnings, including bonuses, rose by 4.6% in the second quarter of the year. That's down from 5% in the previous three-month period. What do all of the figures, what does all of the data tell us about the health of the economy? Let's speak to fellow associate at the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, Fergus Jimenez England. Fergus, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How bad is this? Should we be worried? More to the point, should Rachel Reeves be worried?
I think the labour market data today is certainly consistent with cooling, and we've seen that over this year so far. And I think it is true that the hike in employer NICs earlier this year has had a dampening effect on hiring activity. We're seeing vacancies fall and the unemployment rate rise over time. But I think a separate question is whether it's an outright deterioration we should be worried about. I would rather interpret today's data, and indeed the data preceding it, as consistent with a gradual cooling.
And what can be done and what should be done to arrest a gradual cooling? Is it cause for concern at this point?
Well, so wage growth today, the numbers have shown that it has slowed, but it's still